So why aren't there more women in science, technology, engineering, and math? It's the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and the acronym is STEM, or STEAM if you add art. And last month, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission released a study finding that a little more than one-fourth of STEM leadership positions in our federal government are held by women. One-fourth. Our guest this morning has been charged by the National Science Foundation with helping to answer this question, but I'll ask you as well. Why? What's behind this discrepancy? 1-800-642-1234 to join us, or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, Jennifer Shuttlefield Christus, an associate chemistry professor at UW Oshkosh, the director of the UW System Alliance for Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Advancement in STEM. And she is leading a million-dollar National Science Foundation project that aims to increase and retain women in the STEM fields. Jennifer, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Welcome. Good morning. Thanks.
Let's just begin with your backyard, as you are an associate chemistry professor at UW Oshkosh. Tell us a little bit about the gender discrepancies in our STEM fields right where you are this morning at UW Oshkosh.
Well, thanks for having me. We are a team of folks at UW Oshkosh that are really trying to look at the gender equity representation across our three campuses. So what we observed was that there were only about 35% women in our STEM departments, which is underrepresented if we think about the national statistics, which is generally women should be around 50%. And so our grant is looking to start to think about how we can increase gender equity at UW Oshkosh.
And what has your experience as a woman in the STEM field been like, Jennifer? I mean, anecdotally, without the science, but just the experience, what do you see?
Yeah, well, my experience has generally been at Oshkosh, interestingly enough, I actually didn't realize that those were the numbers. I think that speaks to the strong collaborative environment that we have with the women at UW Oshkosh in the STEM departments. When Dr. Alicia Johnson, who's the interim university diversity officer and director of the Women's Center, and I sat down to think about this particular project, I was a little shocked actually at the numbers. I was surprised and really wanted to start looking at this in more detail.
Yeah, and so when we're looking at a gender discrepancy, it's hard not to, in the STEM fields, I'm also immediately think about women of color, LGBTQI plus staff experience in STEM departments. And what do we know about the discrepancies, disparities that we find there, Jennifer?
Absolutely. Like that, just generally, we see people with multiple marginalized identities actually also have not achieved any sort of gender equity. And so, and specifically at UW Oshkosh, that's something, again, that we want to focus on. We want to make sure that we're looking at all of these different intersections and bringing that into our work.
So we're talking about women in STEM this morning and the steps Wisconsin University is taking to close that gap and empower women. UW Oshkosh Professor Jennifer Shuttlefield Christus is our guest, and she's leading the National Science Foundation project aimed at increasing and retaining women in academic science and technology, engineering and math, or STEM. You can join our conversation with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. And as you mentioned, Jennifer, you've got a team of people examining how to increase diversity in STEM at UW Oshkosh, and you're planning on, as I understand, developing some sort of dashboard or tracking for progress. As you mentioned, you were sort of surprised by the numbers you found at UW Oshkosh, so let's put them up there. And how would this dashboard, as you see it, contribute to the gender equity at the university?
Yeah, I think one of the things that, you know, from my experience, as I said, I didn't feel the numbers. And so we really believe that if we bring transparency to those numbers, that will help just better the conversation. It will help us think about the policies and procedures that we're creating and really help us to just, you know, again, put numbers, put data to what we see happening in departments, and maybe that will help departments think about their decisions as they go through processes.
So it's use the scientific method to study why there is a gendered imbalance in our science fields.
Yeah, and there are definitely the advanced grant. So that's the grant that we were awarded from the National Science Foundation. The advanced program has been around for 20 years. They just celebrated their 20th anniversary last year, and there are a number of just known best practices, and so we are building on. You know, we're using key strategies from those best practices that have been learned over time. And so we're going to be trying to implement those at UW Oshkosh with the hope that then we can also just help inform UW system and then the nation.
You're not reinventing the wheel here, Jennifer. You're building on some of the science that's already been done into the research of the disparities in gender and inequities that we find in the science fields.
Yeah, we are definitely building on previous work. But one of the things that's really interesting about Oshkosh is the way that we chose to integrate after the restructure. And our restructure was an integration model. So our colleagues on the Fox Cities and the Fond du Lac campus were integrated into the STEM department, into all departments, actually, not just STEM departments, but most of the UW system institutions decided to keep their 2-year campuses as branch campuses, whereas we chose a different model. And I think this will lead to some really interesting work, and it also might mean developing new methods or new strategies.
Sure, Jennifer. I, when we talk about the disparity, I'm wondering, do you find a concern that publicizing these disparities could actually stigmatize women in departments or discourage women from entering the STEM fields?
That is something, you know, that people have talked about. If you talk about how, you know, the climate might not be great, that then people might not entertain that career. But I hope that they see that, you know, we're working on this, that this is that there are people that, you know, want to make sure that there are opportunities available for everyone of all different identities. And so we continue to work and try to improve climates and cultures.
So what are some of those best practices that you plan on building on, Jennifer? And I'm sure there's a slew of them, but is there top of mind ones that immediately jump to your mind?
Well, so oftentimes, just one, making sure that people are aware of the data, that's one. Also, looking at policies and procedures just to make sure that those are equitable. Also, doing training. So training is another one. So there are a number of different things that we can do, but typically transparency tends to be at the top of them. So trying to make sure that people are being transparent in their selection process. So utilizing rubrics when doing hiring practices or evaluation practices, and just making sure that you know, those rubrics are followed as people go through their promotion pathways.
Our guest, Jennifer Shuttlefield Christus, an associate professor of chemistry at UW Oshkosh, the director of the UW System Alliance for Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Advancement in STEM, and also the leader of a National Science Foundation grant that is looking at the disparity in gender in the STEM fields. If you are involved in science, technology, engineering, and math, and you see this disparity too or feel it, what do you do about it? How do you take action? What role do you play? 1-800-642-1234. It's worth asking the question of you this morning, as well as our expert, as we continue the conversation. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. So when it comes to overcoming the gender gaps in science, technology, engineering, and math, do we all have at least some small role to play here, even if we're not directly involved with the STEM fields? It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest is an associate chemistry professor at UW Oshkosh. Jennifer Shuttlefield Christus is also the director of the UW System Alliance for Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Advancement in STEM, and she is the leader of a National Science Foundation project aimed at increasing and retaining women in the sciences. And she may be the best person to answer this question, but I'll also ask you, what, if anything, can you do to support women and gender non-binary people in the fields of STEM? Join 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. And before our underwriters, Jennifer, you were talking about the training that you're planning on. UW Oshkosh is planning to provide some training to raise awareness about the inequities among the STEM faculty and gender. And the National Institute of Health says mandatory one-time training can be ineffective. So how is UW Oshkosh ensuring its training creates change, Jennifer?
Well, I think when we think about training, oftentimes it's something, you know, that we do that is maybe we're interested, maybe we're not, or maybe we're, you know, watching a video on our computer while we're doing something else. we would really like to make these disciplinarily focused. And thinking about utilizing real stories. And I think that when you utilize real stories and real institutional data and come back to the aspects of what's happening at your own institution, it helps us to think about, like, you know, we look at our colleagues a little differently. It becomes personal then. And so we hope that when it becomes personal in that sense, it becomes more meaningful. And that people recognize that there is a need for a change then.
Not a statistic which is difficult to empathize with, but an experience which is impossible not to empathize with. And yet this training, as I understand it, Jennifer, would use specific data to demonstrate gender inequities. Is this because, as you mentioned early, data awareness may be the first obstacle we have to overcome here?
That's what we're hoping. We did a STEM climate study at UW Oshkosh in the fall of 2021. And some of our data really just indicated that people were just not really aware. And so we hope that doing some of these trainings will just help bring awareness. And when it's at the front of your mind, then you tend to make different decisions.
Yeah, we're talking about UW Oshkosh addressing gender inequity in STEM fields with Jennifer Shuttlefield Christus. She's an associate chemistry professor at UW Oshkosh. And the university recently announced a $1 million grant from the National Science Foundation to increase and retain women in STEM fields. But I also want to ask you about your role as the director of the UW System Alliance for Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Advancement in STEM. Because, Jennifer, I think a lot of companies and a lot of industries have some diversity, inclusion, or equity program. But tell me a little bit more about how Advancement plays into your work in the UW system as the director of the Alliance here.
Yeah, that's great. I love that you picked up on the word advancement. Our program has an advisory board that consists of two members from each UW system institution. And our advisory board members were really excited about that particular term. Because in thinking about persisting in STEM, that doesn't necessarily mean that you've had success in STEM. Persisting is great, but advancement is really key and critical, which is why we really wanted to bring that particular term in. As you noted at the start of the show, women still continue to be underrepresented at the higher levels of employment, and so we want women to move through and be represented throughout the entire gamut of jobs and positions. And so that's also actually one of the noted barriers to gender inequity is just a lack of role models. And so that's a place where advancement really comes in.
Well, and what role would that play in tenure? UW Oshkosh says they anticipate a quarter of their tenured STEM faculty will likely retire in the next 10 to 15 years. And so how will UW Oshkosh review its tenure system through the lens of equity and advancement?
Well, we're hoping again that comes back to just an increase in policy transparency. Oftentimes policy ambiguity leads to people leaving just leaving the workforce in general. And so especially when you come from a marginalized identity, then it becomes all that much more difficult to understand the pathway forward. And oftentimes there are other hidden labor costs that go into that when you do come from a marginalized identity. And so we really want to make sure that these policies are transparent in the process. People know what they need to do to move forward and to get through the tenure process. And then also beyond the tenure process, I would even say to go, you know, to continue their career, to go to full professor.
Jennifer, you talked earlier about the need for role models, and Jennifer Shuttlefield Christus joins us as a role model this morning. What got you into the field, STEM fields? What was it that made you so curious that you kept going?
Oh, that's a great question. I took chemistry in high school, and I loved it. It was it was something that. For me, I actually think the math was the best part. It was the integration of the math and the science. And so I just continued on. I liked it in high school. And then I followed that pathway into college. And I would say my pathway in college was not, I was a first generation student. It was not necessarily a pretty pathway. I did get an economics degree also, in the process.
Wow.
So, I ended up with a chemistry and economics degree, but it took me 6 years to do that. So it was just an interesting pathway, but I really have always just liked chemistry and, I like science in general. And so, I was fortunate enough to have people, mentor me and push me along the way. And so I'm excited to be here today to continue to do the same.
I can tell. And what advice would you give for young women who are excited by the sciences or hoping to become engineers and are looking at math as a problem to solve in a fun way? What would you say to them this morning?
Yeah, I think that, one of the things that I would say I would try to do is I would try to find somebody like me. There are a number of us out there that want to help, that want to, you know, be your champion and support you and do whatever we can to help you along the path if there is a struggle or if there isn't a struggle. And so we just want to, you know, cheer people on and continue to help them get to where they want to go. And so that's, I think that's part of why we go into these roles as faculty members, that you, in the end, especially at a primarily undergraduate institution, you want to help your students succeed and get to wherever they want to go. And so we're here to help support that process.
And Jennifer, do we play a role in this, even if I'm not in science, technology, engineering, or math? I mean, we certainly have engineers here in the building. It's how we're on the air. But what role, if any, do I play in finding some gender equity in our STEM fields?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's always an opportunity in particular to just help create a culture of inclusion and equity. And so if you see an experience or if you see something that you think could be improved, then, you know, take that opportunity to step in and say something or do something. And so we all have that opportunity. And I think that that's where, you know, we can all start to work on culture. Right. And we can all start to be encouraging and help people try to get where they want to go or do the jobs they want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and as we're wrapping up here, so are we going to take this national once the National Science Foundation grant wraps up and the study is complete and your work is done for the NSF? What happens next?
Well, I imagine that our work isn't going to be done after 3 years. At least that's probably our hope. We have a lot of things to do. And so, we're going to keep on moving forward, but yeah, we will disseminate this work. So we'll take it and we'll present at conferences and talk, you know, to the different institutions at System and let them know of our experience and hopefully that people can learn from that.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Jennifer Shuttlefield Christus, Associate Chemistry Professor at UW Oshkosh, Director of the UW System for Alliance for Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Advancement in STEM. And she's leading a UW Oshkosh National Science Foundation project aimed at increasing and retaining women in science, technology, engineering, and math. Just ahead this hour, a recent UW-Madison study found that just 15% of commercial CBD products are accurately labeled. 15. A pharmacy professor joins us to explain what really is and is not in those cannabinoid products or CBD products. We invite you to join in if you've used CBD and found it to be inconsistent in its active ingredients. Perhaps there's a good explanation why. And that follows the news. Phone number to join us, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn. News update is next. And then a Wisconsin Life here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and now let's take some time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about poetry and farming.
The poetry in Daniel Smith's book, Ancestral, reflects on life and farming in the Driftless area of Wisconsin. WPR's Tim Peterson spoke with him about his poetry on an early spring day in his barn near Arena, Wisconsin. Smith shared three poems about heritage, loss, and an appreciation for the wild.
I thought I would start with a poem called Anvil, which deals with the move to this land that we are standing on this morning and leaving our ancestral home, a farm in northwestern Illinois. Anvil. I've hauled my father's anvil due north, up out of the black Illinois farm ground. He and I together worked decades our home. Set down 60 pounds onto the floor of this old barn, new only to me. All around, our bewildered tools hang in the strange light of the cracked window pane, where I stand looking out over land not yet home. It is growing late on a late winter's day. At my feet, my father's anvil. His striking song of steel on steel, still hammering home. This next poem is about a neighbor of mine who passed away several years ago. A man had welcomed us to our new home here in Wisconsin, and then suddenly became ill and passed away. And it's called A Farmer Dies in Springtime. Home from the hospital, to a bed with a view of the fields. Tended by hospice, who arrive morning and night, like a hired man come to chore. Neighbors stop by, sit bedside, stare into their hands, red and cracked from winter. They recall the year of the early frost, flood, or big drought. They avoid talk of the plowing or planting, of the futures for cattle or corn. The tractor, disc, and planter stay locked in the shed with seed bought months ago when the new catalogs arrived, glossy with promise and primed for a year that would not be. Now that I have grandchildren, one of my inspirations for writing is to share things with them that I hope they'll read when they get older, and that they still live in a world that gives them beauty and an appreciation of nature. One day while I was walking, I came across a red fox, which is rare to find in the open, and I wrote this poem for my grandchildren called The Red Fox. I saw a red fox drinking from the horse pail in the pasture south of the barn. A winter sunset blazed upon his hide, and his black ears pointed toward the early stars. Suddenly aware, he bolted for the dark woods, but I did not follow. It was enough to know he exists, to know this world still shelters the rare and the wild.
Daniel Smith is a poet and president and CEO of Cooperative Network. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Now, if the labeling on the rest of our medicine bottles were accurate 15% of the time, what percent of us would still be alive and kicking this morning? It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent, and our next guest is the senior author on a new study that analyzes what active ingredients are found in CBD or cannabidiol products across southwest Wisconsin and how that compares to what's on their labels. Does CBD work for you? If so, does it work inconsistently? Perhaps there's a reason. Join us, 1-800-642-1234, with your questions about CBD or email ideas at WPR.org. We'd also be interested in your personal experiences with using CBD. Our guest is Barry Goodell. He is a professor of pharmacy at UW-Madison and the senior author of this new study. Barry, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Good morning.
So set the scene for us, if you would. Your study looked at almost 40 commercial CBD products, all of them found across southwest Wisconsin. And what did you find?
Sure. So before I get there, I do have to give a shout out to my former grad student, Dr. Owen Miller, as well as Dr. Ed Elder. Because, you know, in reality, they did the lion's share of the work in the lab. So I want to thank them for all their work. But so what we did, this is a lot of us have recognized this for a while, that there's, you know, it's kind of the Wild West out there. There's very little FDA oversight of these commercial cannabidiol products that are out there. They fall under what's called the Farm Bill, and, you know, derived from hemp, you know, cannabis sativa. So there's very little regulation. And a lot of us have recognized for a while that there's problems. We've heard from individual patients over the years that, you know, sometimes they feel like they get some benefit from the products, other times they don't. So we set out, there was a study that was done a few years ago that looked nationally at the same thing that we did. And letters went out to companies saying they need to be standardized and have some quality assurance. So we decided to reproduce that here in the state of Wisconsin a few years later. And what we found was almost the same.
Oh.
That, you know, a lot of products just don't have what they say they do.
Wow. So you found 6 products tested were accurately labeled out of the 39 that you studied?
That's right. You know, either they had, some of them actually had more CBD than what they claimed. But, you know, the majority had, you know, far less. And what was more concerning, some of the products that we looked at, they didn't really give you, you know, an amount. It was labeled, you know, as this full spectrum hemp. So it was very hard, you know, for us to say, well, what do they really have? They would give you a concentration, a dose, but you didn't really tell you specifically what was in it. And of course, that's not something if you went to the pharmacy counter, even over the counter, you know, medicines that you would expect to see, right?
Sure. And Barry, was there a reason, as you understood it, that so many of these CBD products contained less CBD than were indicated on the labels?
Well, you know, I think it gets back to what are the requirements for quality assurance? You know, there's, again, with prescription drug products, there's fairly, and over-the-counter medicines that you'd buy in the pharmacy, there's requirements for quality, ongoing quality assurance. That when a, you know, a drug manufacturer puts something out and what it says on the label, it's pretty much got to be pretty darn close to that. There is no such requirement for these products. So, you know, that's the problem. It's inconsistent manufacturing.
Yeah, but is there, I mean, is these cannabinoids, they're, yeah, can they dissolve in water? Are they good in beverages? Is it a soda that you can slurp up on a sunny day?
So, yeah, thanks for asking. So here's one of the things about these cannabinoids. They're what we call lipophilic. They love fatty environments, right? So most of the oils or most of the preparations you find out there, they're dissolved in things like olive oil or other types of oils. So we knew from the get-go, or we suspected from the get-go, that, you know, we looked at a variety of these CBD waters and beers and kombucha and all these other things, that there was likely to be very little, because cannabinoids just don't like being in water like that. And that's really kind of what we found. First of all, there's negligible amounts of CBD to be found, and some of them it was hard to determine, but some of them had almost nothing in them. So buyer beware.
Yeah, but so give us a big picture here, Barry. How much does it matter that these commercial CBD products are incorrectly labeled? And as we'll get to, you've been studying cannabis sativa products for a while now, the first one approved by the FDA that you've been working on for a long time. So why is this important?
So I think there's a couple things here. My first concern is that I think a lot of patients and consumers out there, they're taking the information that they've heard about the prescription product, and they think that's the same stuff that they can go buy over the counter. And the concentration, the doses are far, far different, but people don't, they kind of miss that subtlety. I do worry about drug interactions and side effects. You know, one of the things that we've worked on are that these cannabinoids, CBD and THC, can cause some drug interactions, and it can be dangerous drug interactions. Problem is, I don't know, with some of these over-the-counter products, is that enough to cause a drug interaction, because it's never been studied. But you know the other thing, real quick, and I'm sorry to interrupt, the other thing that's concerning that we found in our study, a fair number of these products had measurable amounts of THC in them.
CBD products that actually had THC. CBD, which was allowable under the 2018 Farm Bill, THC, which still is not, according to the federal government in the state of Wisconsin.
That's right. And, you know, it's, you know, this it becomes kind of a math problem, right? So as long as it's below 0.3%, it's considered legal. Well, some of our products that we tested, they were right up, you know, up to the legal limit. And if you do the math on some of these, that, you know, we know that you can get a measurable effect from THC at about 2.5 milligrams of THC. And you get up to 10 milligrams of THC, that clearly can be an intoxicating dose. And if you wanted to, some of these products, if you wanted to spend the money, you could buy a bottle of it, and you could probably get a couple intoxicating doses, you know, out of THC out of the bottle. So I worry about that. I worry about the fact that it's not regulated. Yeah. You know, young people can get a hold of this. The other thing is, if you're subject to drug testing, you know, you could turn up positive. There's enough THC that you could have a positive urine test. That can obviously cause some legal problems.
Barry Goodell is a professor of pharmacy at UW-Madison. He's the senior author, along with Dr. Owen Miller, was the lead author, Dr. Ed Elder as well, mentioned them once again, on a recent paper that analyzed commercial CBD products in stores across southwest Wisconsin. 39 of them, only 6 seem to match the labeling requirements. So what does that mean for CBD users in a largely almost completely unregulated market? And what does that say about the need for some regulated state? Join the conversation about CBD, THC, and what you'll find. We don't know. 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Guest has been researching the first prescription medication derived from cannabis sativa for a while now. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and Epidiolex was first approved by the FDA in 2018 to treat seizures. Barry Gadales oversees his patients' use of Epidiolex in his clinical practice. He's also the senior author of a new study about commercial CBD products available across southwest Wisconsin. And that study is published in the journal Epilepsy and Behavior. What do you want to know from our expert about CBD? Barry Gadales is also professor of pharmacy at UW-Madison. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas at WPR.org. So, Barry, tell us a little bit more about your work with the cannabis sativa plant and how it is used as medicine to treat seizures.
Sure. So, you know, we've suspected for a long time that, you know, there's a lot of compounds, a lot of these molecules, cannabinoids that are in cannabis sativa. And it's really only been in the last decade or so that there's been serious research looking at their potential medicinal properties. And so it's been recognized that CBD, when given in sufficient doses, can be in a very effective anti-seizure medication in some groups of patients. So, you know, you mentioned Epidiolex. That is the first FDA, the only FDA-approved product that's a purified form of CBD. So, you know, as we mentioned last before the break, some of the over-the-counter things we tested had THC. Epidiolex, because of the process, the oversight and the process, doesn't have any.
And you found it to be effective in treating seizures?
Yeah, it's been, you know, shown in clinical trials, and we have a number of patients that have been very successfully treated with CBD using, again, the prescription product, which is given at much bigger doses than what you can buy in the over-the-counter world.
But it begins to explain why you were so interested in studying the other CBD, over-the-counter CBD products, commercial CBD products that some of your patients would have available to them over-the-counter across southwest Wisconsin. Have you had patients that have come to you about finding, in addition to Epidiolex, also adding some commercial CBD products? How does commercial CBD play into, you know, your work with the pharmacology of cannabis sativa?
Yeah, I don't see that as much as we did in the early days when we had Epidiolex, but we've had patients who would try, you know, supplementing themselves, and whether it had any measurable effect, I don't know. Did have some patients that were using, the over-the-counter stuff, and they were complaining of some side effects. Maybe that was due to the THC. It's hard to say. Mm. But a lot, there was a huge groundswell of interest, you know, after the farm bill, for people wanting to try it.
Mm-hmm. But that its effectiveness is still into question. And as your study points out, Barry, it appears as though the consistency of the product may also be in question. So that would lead us to what advice you might have for consumers if they want to continue to purchase over-the-counter CBD products and they want to have some certainty about the correct amount advertised in it.
Yeah, great question. Unfortunately, there's really nothing, you know, the consumer can do to sort of verify the amount that's in there. You know, they may be given some, you know, a QR code on something where they showed some initial, you know, purity measurements, but that really doesn't tell you what's in that bottle. And we do know over time, especially after the bottles have been opened for a while, that CBD begins to degrade in the bottle. So, you know, I also worry about people who are trying to self-medicate, treating various symptoms. My advice to them, if they're trying to self-medicate, you know, go have a conversation with your physician first about what's happening and what you're trying to treat. And my other thing is, you know, if you're going to use these products and try them, you know, talk to your physician or pharmacist about, you know, if you're taking other medicines, because again, we just don't know that there may be drug interactions, even at the lower doses some of these products have. We just don't know.
Do we see any push or any drive towards regulating the CBD market after it opened up in following the Farm Bill in 2018?
Well, you know, over the last few years, the FDA has had hearings. I was provided some testimony at one of those hearings a couple years back. I think there is interest. I frankly think the genie's out of the bottle, no pun intended. You know, that these products are proliferating. I think it's going to be very hard to have any sort of regulation of the over-the-counter space.
But I just find it, I mean, these are supposed to be medicinal, these are supposed to have healing, but how can you treat it as medicine, and how can you treat it as healing if you are uncertain about its toxicity, its potency, its effectiveness?
Right. Well, you know, again, the way the current laws are crafted, you know, the companies out there that are selling this stuff really can't make medical claims. You know, if you're selling over-the-counter CBD, you know, whether it's in, you know, in candy bars or water or even in oil, you can't say it will treat, you know, fill in the blank disease. Only the FDA approved products like Epidiolex mm-hmm. can make that claim because it's been studied in a rigorous manner. So, you know, patients need to understand that if they're buying something, it's not the same as the prescription product. They can't assume it's going to treat anything.
Barry, you talked about testifying a couple of years ago, and what have you learned about CBD that could help inform policy debate going forward now, and the question over regulation of CBD, and as we move forward, the legalization of THC products themselves?
Well, one of the things that I think we've learned, we're learning more, and we continue to explore and learn about, like I said, the drug interactions. That CBD, especially given in doses that we know can treat seizures, for example, it can interfere with other medicines that you're taking, and potentially cause, you know, very, very serious, you know, effects, like with some anticoagulants, blood thinner type medicines. We know that CBD can cause them to be much more enhanced in their effect, and that, you know, puts you at risk for bleeding. So we're learning more about the drug interactions, and I think there's this growing sense that these are not benign molecules. These are not benign drugs. They can have some serious consequences. So whether that impacts public policy toward the over-the-counter space, I don't know the answer to that. Go ahead.
Yeah, we're just about out of time here, but I am interested in what you are working on next and what you see on the horizon for your studies.
So what we're continuing to work on, again, is drug interactions. One of the other things that I mentioned is that we know that, you know, once, unlike a lot of other medicines, once you open the bottle, you know, whether of the CBD, it begins, once it's exposed to air, it begins to break down and degrade. So we're beginning studies to basically inform consumers if they're buying a bottle and they're using it every now and again, how long is there even anything left in the bottle after they've opened it? Because I think, again, consumers need to know that. They're spending a lot of money
yes.
for these products. So it's good to know how long they'll actually be worthwhile. And we're continuing to study how well it's working in our patients.
Barry, look forward to keeping up with your work. Thanks for sharing it with us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me.
Barry Goodell is a professor of pharmacy at UW-Madison and the senior author on a recent paper that analyzed commercial CBD products in stores across southwest Wisconsin. Of 39 of them, 6 actually met the label as detailed. Just ahead, we talk with the overseer of NASA's James Webb Space Telescope after its images revealed the deepest ever snapshot of time and space itself just a little more than a week ago. What did we find? That's next. I'm Lee Rayburn. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.